presentation will be on the page 62 from Bi Yan Lu, the Boot Rock Collection. And it's entitled Wu Meng's One Treasure. Angle's introduction. With untaught wisdom, he engages in the subtle action of inaction. With unsolicited compassion, he becomes your true friend. With a single word, he kills you and saves you. In one move, he lets you go and holds you fast. Tell me, who is it that comes in that way? See the following. Main subject. Wu Meng said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. It is hidden in the mountain form. You take the lantern, entering the Buddha hall, and take the temple gate, place it above the lantern. Sechos verse. Look, on the ancient bank, who is that holding the fishing rod? Quietly moving clouds, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white flowers of the reeds, you see by yourself. Thanks for coming to the sit. Kerr is away doing a presentation, so he asked me to lead the Saturday sit. My name is Jaru, in case some of you don't know me. I start to practice with Kurt in 1994 when Kurt just started the sit in this writing center. Back then I was a graduate student living in Quad, so it's like 5 minutes away from me, so it was very easy for me to come here to sit with Kurt when I was a graduate student, four days a week. And even before that, I was already a Buddhist, you know, practitioner in Taiwan. I started to be very interested in koans, or, you know, gongan in Chinese, or the things, the most famous ones, like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? You know, whenever I was tired from studying, preparing for my college entrance exam when I was about 17 or 18, you know, sometimes I would read those koans and just be very fascinated by it. And I actually vowed to myself, you know, if I ever enter the college at all, I will start to practice. I didn't even know what, you know, this thing called koan training. It's different. We describe it different way in Taiwan, or in the context of Chinese Zen Buddhism. So, and I got into a college, and the first day during the orientation, I found out the Buddhist, you know, the Students Buddhist Association in my school back then, and I stayed there practicing, or, you know, I was part of that group for 4 years, and that was actually probably, you know, one of the most fascinating, the best moment in my life. You know, I hang out with all these Buddhist students, friends, and we would do morning or evening sutras, not every day, but, you know, probably once a week, and we form a reading group where we would study, you know, sutras, and we have sutra memorization contest, you know, and we had to memorize the Heart Sutra in Mandarin, and you know, we have all kinds of activities, you know, for kids of that age. And we even form a trip to a particular Buddhist monastery in the mountain, and it's not walk. We did not walk or take a bus up. We actually did prostration all the way up from the bottom of the mountain all the way up. It took us 5 hours. So we started at 12 midnight. So we will walk 3 steps, and then 1 prostration, and then 3 steps and 1 prostration, and we did that all the way climbing up to the mountain. And we would chant. I believe we were chanting Kanon's name, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And so I back then I was already very devoted practitioner, but in Taiwan, it's not like in Japan where the Buddhist schools are kept very sort of distinctly. If you are a Soto Zen, or if you are Pure Land Zen, so you stick to your own your own school and you don't mingle. But in Chinese, because I think the Chinese nature is more syncretic, so we sort of mix them up. So we would chant Buddha, we would study, Buddha, study Buddhist text, and we would debate, and we would do meditation, and we would do prostration, we would do mantra, and also sort of recite Buddha's name, Amitabha Buddha. It's more of a Pure Land. So in Taiwan, it's more of a mix of Zen and Pure Land Buddhism. And the dominant Zen school in Taiwan is Soto Zen. So usually students would, would be assigned one koan, and they work on it for the rest of their lives. And just stick to one koan. That's it, And I was very interested in koan, but back then, the teacher that we were studying, that was sort of leading, is actually Shen Yan Master, and he actually passed away several years ago. He was the founder of the Dharma Drum Buddhist group, and he himself is actually a Zen monk, but he actually, because he has so many different students coming from all kinds of backgrounds, so he sort of diversified his teaching, doing different things to suit different people's needs. But my heart is always, Zen. I was always very curious about koan, and I would hear story about my classmate, my Buddhist friend went to Sesshin's and she had the Kensho experience, and I was very envious, and then sort of whenever I see her, I always feel like she has an aura on her head, she's like walk differently, or she's like behaving differently from the rest of us, right? So, but I never had, the idea of Sesshin actually terrifies me when I was in Taiwan. I actually fled once. I went there, and on the day 3, I couldn't stand it anymore, so I left. So it was not until I came here to Rutgers and I met Kurt, and I think that was my sort of the starting point of my formal training in koan training in Zen. And my passion for this practice and for koan training has never lessened a bit. I'm still fascinating it by there are very few things in my life, or probably in everybody's life as well, that you are so engrossed, so passionate about one thing, And for me, that's actually koans. So that's just a little bit about my background. And I was actually ordained by under Kurt in 2004. Back then, after that, I was very busy with my career. So, I did not really spend too much time on, with our group. I was, I moved to different parts of the country, very different places. And recently, well, several years ago, I came back. You know, I found a job in New York. And right now I live in Manhattan, and I found, very luckily, I found a Zen monastery actually only 10 minutes away from my home. So I went there every day now at 6:30 in the morning to sit with them. And I would get up every day 5:30 and, you know, so have my breakfast and then getting ready and you know, ring their bell at 6, you know, at 6:20. And that group was sort of shocked by me, you know, who is this outsider? It's called the First Zen Institute. It was founded in 1930s by a Korean Zen monk. And most of the people practicing there are residents. They stay in that monastery. You know, I think there probably are 7 or 8 people over there, and they don't really have an in-house teacher. You know, they don't have a Roshi there. So I think it's just a very small, secluded Zen community. You know, they practice morning. They have a morning rituals and breakfast, and then every Wednesday they have an opening house. You know, so open to the public, and people can go there, and they will do a presentation on how to do meditation. And every month, there's once a month they will have a film night, you know, where they will show Buddhist films or documentary films. And they do have a monthly sit, you know, Saturday and Sunday. And on Saturday they started at 4:30 in the morning, you know. And this is such an urban experience because, you know, during the break, people can just go home. You know, like me, I can go back to my home, have breakfast, right? And then after 2 hours, I'll go back to the institute to continue to sit until, I believe, 9:30 in the evening, you know. And so this is actually a very wonderful place for me to continue to practice every day in the morning. And my sudden appearance actually probably shocked the community because, you know, they probably haven't had somebody from outside world, you know, going to knock on their door every day at 6:30, you know. And I think sometimes when you're very settled into your lifestyle, it becomes too comfortable, you know. And I noticed that they have not been sitting regularly, you know, and sometimes I just sat by myself, you know, nobody showed up, you know. And eventually they had a meeting and they gave me a key, so allowed me to go over there to sit, you know, every day in the morning or whenever I feel like to. So this is actually a very good, you know, for me personally. And sometimes I do wonder, you know, and well, they have a, by the way, they have a beautiful Zendo. If you have a chance to go to Manhattan and would like to see that place, please let me know. I can show you. It's probably the first Zen monastery in New York, you know, and it's an old house. They bought it a long time ago, pay off the mortgage, and the Zendo is more traditional style. You know, it's actually a 5-floor building, and on the second floor is their Zendo, and inside the Zendo room, they sit on the elevated platform. You know, it's called Khan, and the cushion is a little bit different from ours. You know, we use the round cushion. As in Taiwan, this is pretty much the, you know, I don't know if this is a Chinese one. And the one that they use, it's actually square, you know, the sort of flat and longer, and they stack them up and things like that. So it's a little bit different. And they have a beautiful altar. So when nobody is around, I just feel like in heaven because I can finally do prostration all on my own. You know, it reminds me again and again why I love this path so much, you know. And my point here is, you know, when we practice for a long time, or whether you are beginners or, you know, or you are long-term practitioners, I think it's always a good idea to ask yourself, why are you taking on this path? Why are you coming back again and again and again? You know, and because sometimes it becomes a routine, we stop asking it. We stop asking that question. You know, it's a little bit like my friends, Dharma friends at that institute, that they have such a beautiful Zendo, and yet they are not fully taking advantage of it. You know, I could be wrong. I mean, I probably just my partial observation. I did not see probably how serious they were sitting, you know, on their own. But I would just love to have a Zendo where I could, you know, have a sit with people, you know, every day diligently, you know, and to practice. So I believe what brings us to here or to practice to the cushion, I think a lot of it has to do with let me call it existential trauma, or, you know, unhappiness, unsatisfactory about certain aspect of life, you know, and it's a wound that we are looking for medicine or a cure, right, to address, right, to understand, you know, and this is not something that our system, you know, current education system and kind of, you know, can teach us, you know, and we have to do it on our own by sitting on the cushion, you know. And this is what this koan is about, you know, woman's one treasure. You know, woman, in Chinese, woman is Yunmen, the cloud gate. You know, he is just as famous as other teachers we've been, studying, like woman, Huang Bo, and all those people. And he has his own distinct style, and students follow him later, form a school called the Yunmen School. So this is, we are actually getting a taste of what Wumon's koan is like. So basically, here, Wumon asks the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. You know, when I read this line, I just feel that, oh, this is what, at least me, you know, what I'm here for. I want to know what that treasure is, you know. So he says that, you know, he reveals, you know, what the treasure is. It is hidden in the mountain form. We have to then, you know, sit on the cushion to meditate on this thing called mountain form. In Chinese, I checked the Chinese source. It's Xing Shan. Xing as in shape. You know, Shan is mountain. So it's hidden in a thing that resembles the form of a mountain, you know. So when we sit on the cushion, right, and then we would, you know, work on this mountain form first. Okay, so, well, that would take a lot of sitting, you know, to really become a mountain, right? And then once you become a mountain, then, you know, we could then move to look for or retrieve that treasure, okay? And I always like Kurt when Kurt mentioned, I don't remember he said that nowadays, but in early Taisho's, you know, he actually talked about his teacher, Genki Roshi, used to describe meditation as diving, you know, as the activity of diving. And I like that quite a bit, you know. So we sit, you know, we are like a Dharma diver, you know. We dive into the depths of you know, vast consciousness and to retrieve that treasure and come up to the surface of consciousness and then to become useful in our, you know, to bring it back to the world, you know. So this is what we are actually doing. We dive, you know, and so that there is a treasure in the mountain form. And then when we sit and we just enter deep consciousness or deep samadhi, and then and that would be the subject of conversation between you and the teacher about the treasure. And okay, the second half of this main subject is you take the lantern entering the Buddha hall and take the temple gate, placing it above the lantern. It doesn't really make that much sense, you know, to me. And I actually went back to look at the Chinese text, and I realized that actually the translation is not quite correct. And I really don't blame the translator, because the Bianlu, the Blue Rock collections, the text is very, very archaic. The language is very archaic, and you know, and classical Chinese is never clear, concise to begin with. And then we lost the context of, you know, the conversation between the teacher and the students, you know, in that took place long time ago. So it's really difficult to understand what exactly that they were actually talking about. So basically, I think, if I can find that text from the Chinese one that I printed. Okay, so basically it says, okay, let me read a Chinese one. It's in classical Chinese. So Yan and some other, I believe there's another Chinese student here, probably can understand.
乾坤之内宇宙之间终有一宝密在行山捻灯笼向佛殿里将三门来灯笼上.
So basically, the I think it's saying that within the universe, there is a treasure. It's hidden in the form mountain, or the mountain form. 捻灯笼, and then you take a lantern and walking towards the Buddha hall, okay? And then it's actually, I think the translation should be placing the lantern on the temple gate, okay? So that would make actually more sense. And salmon, the word salmon, it's because there's language change over time. The here, salmon literally translates as three gates. But I did a little bit research on that. Salmon could also be, it's a synonym for shanmen, mountain gate. Okay, so the mountain gate here is the nickname of temple during their time. So basically it's saying, you know, place the lantern above the salmon gate, you know, the mountain gate. Well, what is fascinating about koans is that no matter how archaic the language is, you know, some details might be a little bit screwed up here. But the gist, the main point of the Quran is still preserved. It's so still well preserved that we people, like later generations, you know, after 100 years later, even in a different language, you know, people like Kurt, and still can work on it, still can answer those koans, you know. And it's up to the scholars, somebody like me who is a nerd, like to, you know, understand what exactly it means, right? And we're so worried about making, you know, interpreting incorrectly. But those interpretation actually has no direct connection with whether you are able to answer the Quran or not, you know. There are many times I noticed, you know, Kurt actually mispronounced something or interpret something correctly. Of course, it's not his fault. He's not, you know, he's not a Chinese scholar. He's not trained in Chinese. But Kurt is my teacher. He has the depth of the knowledge in this in Quran. So that's actually something really fascinates me about, you know, this universality of Quran. So basically, if you know, if in the future you have a chance to work on this Quran, and you know, this is what we are here for. Within the universe, there is a treasure, right? We are here. We sit on the cushion, diving into the deep consciousness, samadhi, and then start to look for that treasure. And then once, well, before that, we have to sit like a mountain. We have to sit like a mountain. It itself is another koan question. You know, what does it mean? What is it like to sit like a mountain? You know, it will take a long, long time. You know, it's like working on the breath perception. What is breath? It takes a long time to study, to experience, to observe all the phenomenology of breath. You know, all the different aspects of breath. And, you know, it changes every minute, right? And every time is different. You know, every time, you know, you still, or I still discover something, you know, after many, many years, you know, after I finished working with the breath perception koan, right? And you know, yesterday I was talking about how important posture is, you know. So when we sit for a long time, we become a sort of a, you know, papaya sitter. You know, you sit so comfortably and then you feel like you're like a papaya, very soft and then sitting there. But later on, you know, if you try different posture, if you try to sit very straight, you might experience different type of energy, you know, coming to you. And that energy will bring new insight into your koan, you know. And a lot of it is not your own doing, you know. It's the big self, you know. It's actually coming through, you know, manifest itself through this new energy. So you have to first, in order to really to be able to have a glimpse or to in contact with the treasure, we have to first sit, you know, be a solid sitter, you know. And how do we become the good solid sitter? And that we have to do it every day, you know. So it's really difficult to have an intimate relationship, intimate knowledge of koans without sitting, regularly. You know, it's like I teach language as well. So, I always tell my students, if you don't practice every day, if you only come here once a week and listen to it, to my language class as a lecture class, you're not going to learn how to speak the language, right? You have to work on it until the moment you really hated it, right? You have to have this kind of, sort of very intimate relationship with it, and then it becomes a habit. It becomes effortless, So now getting up at 5:30 for me to go to their monastery is so effortless. I woke up exactly the same time, even before my alarm clock, actually woke me up, And if I don't go there, I feel something wrong. Something is not done. It's the power of habit. So if we make it a habit, make it a point that this is something, if this is something that we are looking for in our life, then try to make it, part of life activity. And if we do it every day, sitting every day, one day, I believe the treasure will manifest it by itself. We cannot make it happen. And the other point about bringing the lantern, and walking towards the Buddha Hall, one of the comments that made by the Chinese monks is not written, that was not read, translated in this collection, the English translated collection, is that the point that was they were trying to make is the treasure is within us. Buddha nature is inside us. It's not in the Buddha hall. It's not in the altar. And we are the one bring that treasure to enlighten, to illuminate the Buddha hall. We benefit, we actually contribute to it. Without that treasure inside us, the Buddha hall is nothing, So we don't seek, we don't look for treasure outside of ourselves, It's not in a Buddha statue, So there's is not in somewhere else, or not even in Zen teacher. I was just reading something that says that there's no Zen teacher, you are your own Zen teacher. And the Zen teacher there is just to help you to verify your experience, And again, and the same, there's no Zen without that one treasure, The point of practicing, what would be the point of practicing? So this is pretty much the koan. And I finished earlier than I thought. We still have 15 minutes. So let me just read Sechel's verse, and then maybe I'll talk about another koan, I guess. Okay, Sechel's verse. Look on the ancient bank. Who is that holding the fishing rod? Quietly moving cloud, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white flowers of the reeds, you see by yourself. So usually, I think Sechel's verse here is the manifestation of the, the mind of a Zen monk, And it's like a quietly moving clouds, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white flowers of the reeds. But the treasure is not that, It's not quietly moving clouds, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white is not a thing over there. Otherwise, we misidentified, you know. But what is it? You know, what is that treasure? It's not me, or that, you know. What is that treasure that pervades the whole universe? You know, this is something you cannot see, right? But you have to see it, you know. Anyway, so. Well, before I finish, let me just talk a little bit about breath perception. This is our first koan, and I don't know if you remember Chris talk about his experience with his breath perception koans. It took him 5 years to pass that koan. Okay, and it actually took me a year to pass it. And that was the early years where we have a very, very, very small group with Kurt. And we used to go to his house, you know, to do such things. We were so small, so we were able to sit, you know, his house is big enough to host maybe 5 people. And I was the only woman back then, or there are a couple of women, but they came and they came and left. So I usually stay in the in their attic, you know, during their Zen, during our sesshin. And back then, I think that was maybe like 25 or 23 years ago. Kurt used to cook. Well, I mean, he's still cooking, you know. But he would cook this kind of Japanese style, you know, very traditional Japanese style. But now it's more Indian. And we would sit long hours, you know. Back then, it was really, actually, breath perception koans. Well, and also the earlier ones, actually, for me, is the most difficult ones. Because back then, we had such a small, very, very intimate group. We practiced for a number of years together. And right now, I think only probably Yen is the one still, you know, practicing with us. And we have very, very long dokusan. You know, because we only have 5 people, so we have the luxury of talking to Kurt, you know, for a long, long time. So sometimes I had a dokusan with Kurt for 45 minutes. And, you know, and sometimes we even had dokusan twice, you know, morning and the evening. So there is really no we can't be relaxed, you know. So we were actually forced to work on koans, even, you know, and that was the, you know, intensity that the practice the sort of during my first breath perception koan training. And that, I think, breath perception, you know, even though it might sound boring, it's not as fancy as the one I'm talking about. What is the one treasure, you know? What is a mountain form, or things like that? Or the later ones, you know, kills the cat into two, you know, or, you know, Seijo split into two. All those amazing koans, or fox. You know, the fox. I forgot what the koan is like. Anyway, so. But the breath perception is really, really the foundation of Zen practice. Breath perception is a foundation of all meditation practice. You know, all religious school or meditation school start with breath, experience with breath. You know, through sitting on a cushion and really focusing on our breath, we began to be very sensitive to the level of our energy, the level of our consciousness. And you know, and we have to do that for a long period of time. You know, we have to have to develop a very concentrated state, you know, of mind, to be very still, you know, at least at early stage, stillness is still very important. You know, remember the mountain form? You know, of course the mountain form will change later, but at beginning, you know, or even for advanced practitioners, when they sit at the beginning of the first 5 minutes, you know, we're just transit from the outside world, right, into a deeper mind. So we still have to go through that transition. Then we have to really, really just focus on the breath itself and putting everything aside. Well, there are so many benefits of breath perception practice or meditation in general. Even if you're not here for the treasure, you know, I know I'm here for the treasure, but meditation could mean, Zen meditation could mean so many different things for so many different people. I know one of my colleagues, she wants to practice Buddhism, it's because she's an activist, you know, she wants to, and also an educator, so she wants to incorporate, you know, what she called a mindfulness practice or a contemplation practice into her, you know, environmental humanity teaching pedagogy, you know. And, you know, with what's going on, what's so crazy going on politically nowadays, right? And we really have no way to go. I've been talking about our mind. You know, we are so saturated with all the news. Every 5 minutes something comes up, you know, shocking us, right? And so dramatic, it's so dramatic, especially, you know, in the last, you know, 7 days, right? So we can't help but being shaken by what's going on, you know, in our political reality, right? And so just for the sake of mental sanity, you know, at least for me, you know, I need that moment to just quiet, to just focus, coming back to my breath and let the breath take you, you know. And we have a saying, you know, saying die on the cushion, you know. So we have to learn to die, to surrender our ordinary consciousness, you know. It's just so polluted nowadays, right, with what's going on, the craziness, and also our personal lives. So we put aside maybe 1 hour or, you know, one morning, you know, every, you know, once every 2 weeks, put aside those things and just surrender our consciousness, our ordinary consciousness, and let it die. You know, don't bring it back, don't bring it here, you know, to this room. And the purity of our breath, you know, just focusing our breath, it will awaken something really deep, the vast, the bigger consciousness inside us. And it will take us, you know, as long as we don't try to control it, you know, try to mandate, try to manipulate, you know, or through judging mind, or through, you know, intellectual or analysis or criticism or fantasy. As long as we sit enough, long enough, our ordinary mind will start to get tired, you know. And sometimes people get dizzy or get sleepy, but that can be addressed. That can be fixed if you feel a little bit sleepy, you know, or feel like tired or something, low, or you feel like you have a low energy. You could try to open, you know, slightly open your eyes, you know, and I always find that very helpful, you know, and straighten your spine and lower open your eyes slightly, and you will realize if you do this kind of practice many, many times or, you know, long enough, you probably will notice that sleepiness or that kind of feeling, they are also illusions. You know, you think you are really tired, you have to sleep. But if you somehow adjust yourself and then become alert, and it actually will go away. It's like thoughts, it's like ideas, you know. Sometimes it's so strong. Of course, biologically, we need to sleep. That's and during sesshin, we should sleep as much as we can. You know, physical fatigue will not produce good results. So, but on the other hand, when we sit on a cushion, when our mind start to wander or we start to feel, you know, sleepy sensation, that could be just another illusion, you know. And I think you could try to experiment with that a little bit, you know, by trying to adjust your posture, sitting straight, and open your eyes, you know, and then you immediately feel a little bit different, you know, and then going back to your breath. And once you do that, you could make a little conscious effort, you know, to try to inhale and exhale. And then when you exhale, try to stay in that place where you feel nothing happening, you know, before the emergence of next idea, next thought, next thinking, or even next breath, you know. So when you go to the end of your breath, nothing happens, right? So that's a place where it's the door, it's the entrance it's the diving entrance where we dive into our vast consciousness, you know, to retrieve the treasure. So we have to always try to go to that entrance, you know. And for beginners, it might seem that nothing happens, but whether it happens or not happen is also our mental judgment. How do you know? How do we know, right? You know, our big mind is working. Our big mind is doing something, but we need to feed them. We need to give them their space, the time. Okay, so that sometimes it happens beyond our knowledge. We did not know, you know. We did not know. And sometimes we realize that only from hindsight. It's that, oh, that was what's going on, you know. And it's pure that we don't know. Because when we know, it enters our consciousness, you know. But it's also important to integrate into our consciousness to become part of the wisdom, right? But during on the cushion, we don't worry about whether we know it or not. What we do is just to follow the method, you know, starting with our breath, using natural breathing technique. Fill yourself out with air and then exhale. Go to the end of your breath. Push away all the ideas, feelings. And then you have to inhale, then you inhale. And then just keep doing that. One thing you might notice, you know, and I don't know if that's already happening to some of you, is that you will notice that you start to have fewer breaths, you know. I don't know how, usually we probably have 12 to 15 breaths each minute or something like that. But if we are in deep sitting, deep samadhi, usually it will be vastly reduced. You know, and sometimes you will even naturally stop, you know. So, and those are very natural. And just let your body, you know, do its own thing. And if you have to inhale, then inhale. And if it naturally stopped, it stopped. And just don't worry, because your body knows what to do. Not our brain. Our body knows what to do. And if we do this long enough, you know, then the door will open. And then after that, you know, you will be working on you'll be moved to another koan, the Mu koan. So